situation. This new addition, filling positions. Looking at the void in myself and feeling what's missing. Better watch the way you're going, better go in the right direction. In the moment you stressing, but you gon' be counting blessings. And I know that for certain, keep on working, open curtains. Haters swerving, cause they ain't ready for your final version. Whoa. I'm never gon' give up, fall down, I just gotta get up.
You're listening to the Tom Ficklin Show with guest host Jesse Turner on WNHH LP 103.5 FM, your home for community radio.
Salutations, listeners. I have two outstanding, amazing, astonishing Connecticut educators with us today. I have Dr. Shelley Jones, professor of mathematical sciences at Central Connecticut State University, the author of a new exciting book called Women Who Count. And I also have the fabulous Professor Lauren Anderson, chair of the education department at Connecticut College. And I believe the co-partner of a brand new community book space in New Haven. We're going to hear all about them today. So how about we start and say, Dr. Jones, could you tell us a little bit about your latest venture?
Okay, well, I have a book called Women Who Count. And it's a children's activity book for children in grades 3 to 8, although I think all children and adults would love it. I am honoring 29 African-American women mathematicians, and I feature the stories about their lives and about their work. In addition to that, I have elementary and middle school math activities. I have word searches for math vocabulary, for students learning new mathematicians' names, because it's well known that when we ask adults and children alike to name mathematicians, they usually name mathematicians like Pythagoras, Euler, Gauss, but they don't usually name mathematicians like Katherine Johnson, Dorothy Vaughan, or Benjamin Banneker. So this is a project of mine that I think is very needed in education. But this is a project that students can use at home. They can use it on their way to grandma's house, waiting in the bus terminal, wherever you want to use it, in an after-school program, at a museum, take the book out. There are even some coloring pages there. So if they're varied activities, I think students will love it. I have palindromes in there and tessellations. And if you don't know what those are, I want you to go and look it up. Because I think you'll have a lot of fun.
I will have to go look them up. But thank you very much. And Dr. Anderson, could you give us a little taste? Because you got a new project too going on here.
I do. I'm also just so excited about Women Who Count, because it's at the heart of what our book space is really trying to be about. So, as you mentioned, I work with teachers, but I also, with my beloved partner, Dolores Williams, and some wonderful community collaborators, have been working on, we're calling it a book space. It's sort of a cross between a community reading room and an independent bookstore, with a sort of curated collection of books that we think are really important to have accessible to folks in the community, but might not be as easy to find on the shelves in other places. And, you know, our real emphasis is on a curated collection of books by underrepresented authors. So that means a few different things. It's sort of amazing to consider some of the statistics. So the publishing industry is actually like 79% white. The folks who write children's books are overwhelmingly like overrepresenting certain groups of people. And then oftentimes, even though we've seen improvements in that over especially the last few years, you know, only 7% of the books that were, for example, produced for children in 2017 were by Black, Latinx, or Native authors themselves. So even though there were like a larger number of books that were about folks of color, oftentimes they weren't produced by what are being called, you know, own voices in the children's book industry. And so this is just a like fantastic example, I think, of the kind of book that an activity book, an interactive book that young folks should be able to like get their hands on. And so the space is really a place where we're hoping people can come to access books like that, not just to buy them, but just to kind of like hang out and, you know, maybe sit down and start figuring out what a tessellation actually is. And also just recognizing, you know, I see my colleague, Dr. Jones's button over here, you know, it says Black Girl Magic. There is so much Black Girl math magic, right, that has been done that people just don't know about.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, it's exciting just hearing her talk. I mean, we're right in line. We're right in line.
Thanks, Jesse. So for getting us together. We're about to cause some real trouble.
This is thanks to Tom Fricklin and 103.5 FM.
Indeed.
They have given us this opportunity to do some teacher talk shows. Mm-hmm. And teacher talk, when I think about it, the things that really matter to our profession are not the things we're really reading or seeing in mainstream media. Teachers aren't concerned about SBAC scores. They're not thinking the Common Core is driving their lives. Mm-hmm. They're trying to bring equity and justice and cultural awareness and excite kids about learning. Mm-hmm. But one of the great promises I'm seeing right now, the promise is not coming from the United States Secretary of Education, our senators, our legislators, our policymakers, our Wall Street people, but the great promise is this culturally relevant pedagogy, and it goes back. It has the research base goes back to the who we call the multicultural grandmother of literature, and that's Dr. Rundine Sims Bishop from Ohio State University, who talks about literature as being mirrors, windows, and sliding doors. And she says, you know, children need to see themselves in books, and when they do, their reading scores are higher. And we back that up with what we call schema theory. It will all, if you know something about what you're reading, you're going to comprehend more. And then she talks about being able to safely be able to look in the window, looking at the lives of others. And this is important, to be able to vicariously be able to see into the lives of Black people, brown people, gay people, straight people, conservatives, liberal, you name it. We need to see these spaces. And then she really talks about that transformational place. She said that's the sliding door. Yeah. That's when you can walk in, and not that you could become that other, but you can walk in their shoes. Mm. And she says the only way you can do that, the transformative power of literature, is when you step into a book written by another. Yes. And you can do that. So I'm all excited about that. I know we have a new commissioner of education. Hey, shout out there. Hope you do a good job and pay attention. Cultural pedagogy. Yes. All right. So tell us about the other night. I was at a book talk you did at the Africana Center, Dr. Jones, and one of the members of the audience, I can't remember it, and I do remember it was a woman, and she said, it's not only mathematicians, it's historians, it's economists, it's engineers, it's scientists. We're all over. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, I think that I chose mathematics because I am a African-American woman mathematician, and I saw the movie Hidden Figures, like many of us did. Black and white, Latinx. We saw that movie and it just blew my mind. I said, wow, I needed to do something about this. And so where could I start? I could start with the teachers that I teach, the pre-service teachers at Central Connecticut State University. But also what I'm finding is that I did something for the teachers that I teach. I did something for the students that they're going to impact. But what I'm finding is people wanted this. And just like Lauren said, it's just something that was on the horizon. Somebody needed to do it. It's not the first book out there, but what I love about my book is that it's an interactive book where students can just pick it up. It doesn't have to follow the Common Core. I put in there what I think kids would like to do, and I learned after doing it that it's called recreational math. So as far as the...
I'm just excited. Recreational math. If you can do that... Kids could see that you have opened up the world of mathematics to them.
And that's what I want them to do. I don't want them to think that someone has to teach them how to do this. Mm-hmm. I have biographies in there about the women, about their lives. When students come to activities that I have on campus. I a lot of times have middle school students. I focus on middle school students. And when they come, they want to know about our real life. They want to know who we are. Mm-hmm. Okay. Even after they learn we're a mathematician, they want to know that we are just real people. They want to know, do we have children? Do we have pets? What do you do in your spare time? But they're also interested to know, how did you do all that math? I mean, that's exactly how they ask me. And so I think kids just need this. They need to know that they're brilliant, that they can do the math. No one has to teach them. They come to school knowing many things. And that's the cultural part of it, is we have to take what they come, not what they don't come, not a deficit look at them, but what do they already know? And we start from there.
Mm. So if we think about, because that's of course beautiful, and we're really talking about seeing the child, not the data, see the human being, see the gift in front of you and getting that. But I want to also touch upon this new place, because when I grew up, the best place for me was my grandfather's living room and grandpa's living room. He had more books than anyone I ever knew. And, you know, it's a third grade education, a World War One war veteran, you know, and he was just full of books, little tiny books, the works of Shakespeare and the size of 2-inch books and big books and atlases. And I remember being in that place. And you see, I went to that place just 2 Saturdays ago. When I went to that People Get Ready bookstore and I sat down there, they were comfortable. It's not Barnes & Noble. Barnes & Noble, you get the cappuccino, papalino, or whatever it is, and you get all that, and there's all the books. No, this was a place where children were running around, playing, reading books. Parents were reading books. There were conversations going on that were powerful and meaningful, and those were the conversations that made me fall in love with books in the first place. So tell us about the comfortable space.
Well, I will say, I think the sort of customer to beat was this wonderful young kid, you know, probably 5, Lucas, who picked up a book on Muhammad Ali and did, you know, circles around around the space saying, I got this book. Just gave me so much joy. We really want it to be a gathering place. And I think books are really, you know, they're vehicles for great conversation. I think we are trying intentionally, you know, to the points that I think Shelley is making about like teachers in particular and what they need. Like we would love to be a resource space for teachers, but also for families who want to like come and see books that they might not otherwise encounter and talk to people about them and the issues that they raise. And I think very much so coming from a kind of cultural wealth perspective, which again, you know, just to sort of piggyback on what Shelley Dr. Jones was saying, is that like so much of what school often does for young folks is convince them that they know less than they do. And that's just such a shame. You know, one of the examples that I just had is actually from one of the resources we have in the store called Lessons from Turtle Island, Native Curriculum in Early Childhood Classrooms, is a simple example of a child being like a teacher holding up a card with a color on it, like the color blue, and saying, what color is this? And the child says, it's the color of the sky. And she says, that's wrong. You know, you're like, she's looking for a single answer, holds up a green card and says, you know, what color is this? And the child says, it's the color of the grass. She says, no, you know, it's green. And of course, like this is the example is that, you know, this is a child that comes from a cultural community that's like deeply grounded in relational understandings of the world. And so it's actually kind of more valid in some ways to call it the color of the sky than to name it as blue. Yes. Another example I use sometimes with some of my students is a really short little story about a child who goes to school and ends up drawing they were tasked with drawing something about butterflies. And so she draws herself killing the butterflies. And her teacher is kind of, you can tell from the way the child recounts the story, the teacher is aghast and like, we don't kill butterflies. She goes home to her grandparents and she sort of, they say, how's school? And they ask her some questions and she says, you know, my teacher didn't like my drawing. And the the grandparents say, well, you know, why? And she said, well, the teacher said, you know, we don't, butterflies are beautiful. Like, we don't kill butterflies. And the grandparents' response to this is, well, your teacher must buy her cabbage at the grocery store. Because, like, from this child's worldview and, like, her family's knowledge of growing things, it's like, you know, the notion of, like, even something like a pest that might threaten, like, a crop or something like that. And just the sense that kids are constantly being told that the knowledge that they have is to distrust that and in many ways to kind of learn to not bring that knowledge into the classroom as the foundation for learning. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just so critical. Like, a lot of play that kids engage in involves math. And absolutely. But we don't recognize it that way. We don't recognize their sort of inherent brilliance, their kind of natural tendency toward learning, yeah. their mathematical thinking that definitely comes way before they're writing algorithms, right, on a page. So I think, like, from that perspective, we would really want the book space to be a place where, you know, people's knowledges can be celebrated and amplified, and especially, I think, sort of uncovered if they are ones that mainstream culture and mainstream schooling have sort of obscured or taught young people to not see as valid, when really they're deeply important and important for their sense of self-worth and their sense of community connection and just their sense of, you know, of pride.
Sure. So if we thought about it, people should understand this isn't feel-good stuff. This is science. Mm-hmm. So I'm a student of Dr. Lewis Mall, mm-hmm. and Dr. Lewis Mall, his research looked at the funds of knowledge mm-hmm. that communities bring. I was at the University of Arizona, where we would make home visits. Home visits would be to discover the funds of knowledge, particularly our Chicano residents mm. in Tucson would have. And we would find people that were smart and bright and gifted in so many ways, in art, in welding, in tile, in building, natural mathematicians.
Absolutely.
We would find them. And it would change the perspective. And then when I would travel up to the Navajo Reservation, so I taught on the Tohono-O'odham Reservation in southern Arizona, and the Navajo have an interesting way about thinking about this. They would say that, well, Jesse, you're a white man. You really can't teach our students, you can't teach Native children how to be Navajo. But they would say, you can use our culture to teach our students. And your mission as a teacher is to know as much and learn as much and come to value the communities that you teach in. And so it's real science, and it makes a difference in a world of teachers that are predominantly white teachers looking to do their best, hoping. And what I'm wondering about, Dr. Jones, is there any effort going on in the communities of education mm-hmm. that seeks to help teachers become more cognizant of the communities they're teaching in? Are you aware of?
Yes, I am. I'm aware of many efforts. I think there are efforts. I know the State Department of Education in Connecticut, the Connecticut State Department of Education, has some information on cultural competence. And then we have the National Council of Teachers of Mathematics, who has the same. They have a position paper on equity. And then we have the National Council, NCSM, Math Leadership, and they have a position paper on social justice. So I'm naming math organizations and also the state organization for Connecticut, because the idea is out there. The problem is many of the school districts and many of the teachers don't know how to implement it. And so they are trying, though. And so I will say that I have gone into school districts, and I've done, and you've done as well, workshops on culturally relevant pedagogy teaching. And how do you do that, and what does it mean? And so sometimes it's as simple as having the parents come in or learning about what the parents do, what's happening in the community. How can I mathematize that? What's the brilliance that is already happening? How do we help kids to see that their parents are smart?
Mm-hmm.
Because I'll tell you, a lot, what's happening in schools many times is we think that school is over here and home is over here. And the students see that as separate things, separate entities. They don't see it together because many times it's not together. And so schools have to make better efforts at bringing the community in, bringing parents in, because some parents have been traumatized in schools, especially as it pertains to math. And so you have people, it's called a math identity. And many people who you ask about math, or when they find out you teach math, oh, you must be smart, or, oh, I can't do math. And in one instance, I was talking to a nurse and I said, oh, you do math every day. She said, oh, yeah, but that's a different kind of math. It's all math. Spatial visualization, when kids are playing, mm-hmm. they're doing math. Art, they're doing math. They're doing ratios and proportions. I think the key is to getting students to see themselves, that you're already doing it, and putting a name to it, connecting it to what they do in the classroom. So they don't think that the book math is different than what they're already doing. And sort of honoring what they do, what they come in with. And they don't have to do it your way just because you're the teacher. You might have them describe or what way they're doing and ask them, do you think, will that always work? Because in math, we have algorithms, but they're not the end all and the be all. There are different ways of getting to that solution that you want. And so I do think there is a will. Some people just need a way. I just really don't think they even know how to bring in the community as it pertains to math.
So if we thought about it, Mr. Commissioner, our legislators and our policymakers, I would take it one step further. Put your money where your mouth is. So what we really need is professional development and opportunities for teachers to become engaged in cultural relevance. That's what we really need. And to give you an example of that, on the Navajo and the Tohono-O-Odham Reservation, mm-hmm. teachers were given small stipends mm-hmm. and would come in the summer, and they would take either Odham history on the Odham Reservation or Navajo history on the Navajo on the reservations, on these nations, where the people would go for walks and tours and go to sacred places. Mm-hmm. Nobody wanted to miss that, trust me. It was great. You got to stay in not a really elaborate hotel, but a dorm room. But just to be in the presence on the Third Mesa, on the Navajo Nation in Chinle Canyon, this is a sacred place to be up there on the Odham Nation on Babakui Peak. These are sacred places, but they're just aesthetically beautiful. But this idea that we can help our teachers through this by taking them on journeys. What does it mean to be Latinx in America? I mean, I just went to see the new Don Quixote Nouveau. It was really cool, updated, modern, and it was fantastic. It was at the Hartford Stage. I mean, that's Miguel Cervantes. That's Man of La Mancha, is one of the most famous books in the history of the world, produced in 350 languages. Mm-hmm. My students need to know that. My students need to know about the Kingdom of Mali. They just need to know. Give you a little example. So it's not just children of color. I get to teach in our literacy center, and so that means I get to hang out with about 40 kids and about 20 teachers every week, and it's a nice thing, and it's fun, and it's the part of my job I love. But I have a little Polish kid come in one day. He's only 7 years old, and he's crying. And I'm saying to him, and I say, what's wrong? And he goes, well, you know, they called me Stupid Polak. And I said, what? Stupid Polak? Polish people? Copernicus, before the world knew that it was the earth that revolved around the sun. It took the Catholic Church 500 years to do that and 200 to forgive Galileo. I said, Marie Curie, Nobel Science Prize, the only person ever to win two Nobel Science Prizes. Not only that, her daughter as well. You can't do any better than that. And that lit up his day.
Yeah.
And this is the potential. While kids, and this is the, for me, when I look at America and I look at our schools, inequity is a major issue. But there's also an inequity of who we are and where we come from as a nation, we're doing less history. We're not reading. We're reading books that we say cite the evidence in the book. We're not saying, well, tell us who the author was. Where did the author come? What was the author's journey? Who are the people that the author is writing about? Where did they come from? And then that idea that they're here in America, because, you know, hey, it's like West Side Story. Only in America, people. Yes. All right. So, Shelley, could you tell us your reaction when, because I've seen some young kids from New Britain, from the public schools, come to Central Connecticut State University in one of our really cool lecture rooms, hanging out with you. What are the students? They look like middle school kids or upper elementary. What are their reactions to you?
I think, okay, so I have different reactions. Some kids come in and they're raring to go. They know they're smart. They've been positioned as smart by parents, by teachers. You know, they're the first ones to raise their hands. Where others have been positioned as, you know, I'm going to give you more time for this. You know, this might be a little hard for you. So they're already set up to think that they can't do it. I have one boy, Nathan. He came in and he started off like that. By the end of, it was a week. By the end of the week, it was a summer math program. By the end of the week, not only did he choose the activity that he wanted to do, but when he presented it, he gave some evidence. I mean, I was just so proud of him. I videotaped it. And I mean, you just should have seen his face. He just lit up because he was ready and he wanted to show the other students what he had learned. So if you position students as smart and you take where they are, he liked music. And we started with that. We started with him making up a song. And I mean, you just should have seen the smile on this kid's face. And when you get to see that, that note, that tells you that you're doing something right. And I do want to go back to something, Jesse, though, that I want people to know that what the teachers need to do is they need to look at their curriculum, because that's what they're afraid of, not doing the curriculum. So they need to look at their curriculum and they need to look at some math tasks that will easily relate to cultural relevance, right? So first learn about your students and then begin to take some of the tasks that you already do. No one's saying you have to do a different task, but take that task and find out how could I include culture in that? Because there's so much culture in things. And some people say math is neutral, it's just numbers. Well, no, it isn't. There's so much math everywhere around you if you just take the time to look at it. And also ask the students too. Ask them what they like. Sometimes what teachers will
simple.
Do. So simple.
But so profound.
Yeah. The teachers will choose sports and music. And that's a good start. But they never pick anything critical. Like Gloria Latson-Billings noticed that. When people say they're using culturally relevant pedagogy, they always pick the nice stuff. You know, art, sports. What about some of the critical stuff? What's happening in their communities? So we got to think outside of the box. But what I say is start somewhere. Choose an activity. Read some literature. There are a lot of examples out there. Rethinking Math is one of them. You go to Rethinking Math, there's so much information out there. They give you some context. They give you topics. They give you people. Because it's how you teach the students. You have to position them as smart. But it's also what you teach them. So it's the context and also the approach.
Mm-hmm. So just reminding listeners.
What she said.
Oh, what she said, ditto. But I'm just reminding our listeners, you're listening to WNHHLP 103.5 FM. And we're Facebook Live in case you want to see our beautiful faces, you know, at least theirs. But in any event, this idea that we're not blank slates. So those children that come to us, they're not blank slates entering into our schools, and we're not filling empty minds. What we're doing is we should be lifting and building upon what they bring. And so, Lauren, I want to go back to that kind of new book space, because who are the people that are coming there, and what are they bringing to the bookstore? Because that's the difference. In Barnes & Noble, when I go there, I don't think they know I'm there. Or they know other people are there. It's not about the people in the bookstore. It's about the books, the coffee, that kind of stuff, the sales. But And that book space on Wally Avenue, where people get ready books, in case you didn't know New Haven, just want to make sure you know, because if you missed that spot. But could you tell us about who are those people?
Yeah, they're neighbors. they're community members. And I think, like, you know, we really like the name People Get Ready for all kinds of reasons. It's long history connection to music. But also, the people part being as important as the ready or ready part. I think it's like, on some level, our initial intention was to do a series of events. We weren't necessarily sure we were going to have space. And that was part of the plan for that, was to also build in time to ask people what they would want. In a kind of community book space, especially one that was sort of aiming in a way to provide a space for people to gather when especially the public libraries aren't open. I love the public library. I think it's a really important place. And I want to give a shout out to all the fantastic people at the New Haven Free Public Library. I love them all so much. And the branches work really, really hard to do incredible things that I think do build on sort of local community knowledge, and reflect kind of who the different populations are that tend to go to different branches, as well as the citywide population. And so, you know, over the course of the year, it really is going to be like people coming in. We have a community survey on our website. We're hoping to ask people, you know, what is it that you want to encounter on the shelves? What is it that you're hoping to have conversations around? It's sort of like, yes, if you build it, they will come. But also if they help build it, if we all build it,
they will definitely come.
If we all build it together and it feels that way to people, and not in an inch deep sense, but in like a deeper sense, then I think that's what makes a place, I think, sustainable, is a sort of sense of community ownership and a sense of really feeling like one of the questions on the survey is like, what would make you feel, if you walked into a place on wait, like what would make you feel the place was for you? You know, and that has to do, I think, when just getting back to schools and like curriculum, is like, what is it that makes young people in schools and also teachers, right, feel like they belong? You know, I think about sometimes I walk into schools, we know the demographics of our teaching force in Connecticut, and we need to work on that. We work on that in a bunch of different ways. We have to. One of which is, I think, having better curriculum, K-12, because I think better curriculum would inspire more young people to want to be teachers, because, you know, it would help them see school as a place that they want to be, not just as students and learners, but as teachers and learners eventually. But, you know, it's like, I think about things like, you walk into so many schools in the state of Connecticut and you see that, like, the staff picture. Ooh. Right? It immediately communicates something to people about who they are in relation to that space and how much they belong there. And so these ideas about like visual culture of a space, kind of the voices that get centered, and also by virtue of that, maybe decentered, that like spaces and the way that they're designed can be a corrective on like white supremacist institutions that constantly center and recenter and center again whiteness, right? So this like takes a lot of work, and obviously as like a white woman, I have to be super conscious about ways that I would be doing that in space too, and I have to have good people around me who can help me check myself on it. But I think it will be, to your question about like who are the people how will the space be responsive to them, that's a project, and I think that's a project in any good school that's working on, and I don't mean, you know, good school, but like any school that's working on equity issues, whether it's an institution of higher education or whether it's a high school or an elementary school, it's like, you're not, in the sort of Paulo Freire sense of like, you're always becoming, like you've never really arrived. It's like the project is ongoing. Mm. Your curriculum's never perfect. Like your visual culture is never done. Because it all has to be in response to the people who are coming through the door every day. and who you are serving, who you are in community with, and then also asking the question of who's not here and why are they not here, and how do we make the space a space that is inviting of them in a way that's really authentic.
Which is, if we look at our schools today, we're 49% of our students are diverse students these days. Our public schools are different today. 49% of our students live at or below the poverty line. We live in different schools today. But I wanted to think about just two simple things, because I'm hearing you two PhDs telling me two very simple things. So Dr. Jones is saying, listen to the children, listen to the students, and then Dr. Anderson is saying, listen to the people, listen to the people. So if I'm thinking about this national education reform movement, it seems to be they're saying, listen to CEOs, listen to Wall Street, listen to people who know how to make money, listen to people who are going to tell you to put up the data and that concept. So listening to our children, listening to the people, listening to parents. And you know I'm wearing red today, and you know why I'm wearing red is because in Chicago, my sisters and brothers in the rank and file have joined with the paraprofessionals in the city, and they are on strike. Not for more money. They're on strike for smaller class sizes. They're on strike for nurses in their public schools. They're on strike for counselors and social workers in their public schools. That's what they're on strike for. And this is the new teaching reality. And that's the exciting thing for me. It's cultural relevant pedagogy. It's this new kind of activism that I'm starting to see. Mm-hmm. It's not enormous yet, but it is a small ripple in the ocean. So could each of you just give me a couple of minutes about, are teachers becoming more activist related, or more, are they speaking up more? I don't know.
I think for sure. Rochelle Gutierrez has something that she calls creative insubordination. And I spoke about that before. And I think that not only do we need allies in education, we need accomplices. We need people in our schools and in our districts that we can rally with. And when I say rally, I don't necessarily mean outside of the schoolhouse. I mean in your classroom. What are some things that you can do differently to bring students and parents into the classroom, to bring things in that are going to be more equitable? If you see that students are in the advanced math classes, your school is 70% students of color, but your advanced math classes are 85% white. There's a problem there. And you know there's a problem there as a teacher. So what are you going to do about that? And there are some things that we can do as teachers, and we need to start doing them. If it's not going to come from administration, and sometimes it does, we need to do things in our classroom that will make a difference for the students that we're teaching. And we know some of those things that we can do, and we need to begin to do those things.
All right. Lauren, any activists coming out over there?
I love teachers, like radical teachers, so much. It's like hard to capture in words. I feel like they are just the most inspiring. Always. And I do think, like, you know, more and more in some ways, the political moment that we're in and just like the extreme examples of, you know, caging children at the border, things like that, it's becoming impossible for people to make the argument that teaching could ever be apolitical, right? Like we make a big point, I think, at Connecticut College of saying like, there is no such thing as apolitical teaching. Like teaching is a political act, and you're either addressing things directly or by your silences and omissions, you're kind of complicit with them. And I think in this moment, it has been a kind of waking up for not just teachers, but the like a broader swath of the population around like what we absolutely cannot stand for and what we have to like actively stand against. You know, like, and I want to just take a second to say that there's been, you know, I went to the rally to bring Mario home, student from New Haven, who is being detained in a facility in Massachusetts under threat of deportation, was taken by ICE. And, you know, it was wonderful to see that there are a lot of teachers there, of course, and students doing the work that is outside of the classroom, but also they're among the teachers who in their classrooms are looking at their curriculum and, you know, building off of what Shelley Dr. Jones was saying earlier, just, you know, who are looking at the curriculum they're supposed to teach and are kind of hacking, like in the good sense, that curriculum in the interests of their students and with their students' cultural wealth in mind, but also with like this consciousness about what's happening in the community that kids are really worried about, need to know about, are asking questions about. It's on their mind and on their heart when they come into the classroom. And so, you know, I think that teachers are a powerful bunch, and that, you know, we have to support those who are on the forefront of kind of organizing their colleagues to do the work on behalf of children. I think the Chicago example is really wonderful because a lot of times people think of teachers who are organizing as organizing for themselves. And I think it's such a great and public example of how what teachers are organizing for often when they're organizing for teaching conditions is they're organizing for learning conditions, right? Having a nurse in a school, that's like a basic human rights issue. Having counselors, having a librarian, having class sizes that are humane and that allow every child to feel seen by educational professionals and educational professionals to do their job well, those things are rock bottom basic. And, you know, I think that there are other things too, like, for example, translation services that need to be a part of the way we do school, given who our students are. And it's really hard to talk about like bringing in families if you have a population of people whose linguistic needs aren't being met by the school. And so how do you have actual back and forth communication? And I really think it's teachers who are asking and demanding for those things, and that those of us who aren't in K-12 schools really need to back them on that and partner with them on those righteous demands.
So if we, I would be remiss if I didn't say thank you to the New Haven, you know, Independent. I would be remiss if I didn't say thank you to Tom Fricklin for giving us this time. I would be remiss if I did not say thank you and praise to 103.5 for giving us the moment to have some teacher talk. I just want to make sure I get that out of the way. And so when I'm hearing this piece, it reminds me of when I taught on the Haudo Autumn Nation, my dissertation and my research focused on what would motivate and engage young Native learners, and what it was culture. So that's one of the things that were there. So final words, ladies.
Well, I just want to say, remember, my book is called Women Who Count, Honoring African-American Women Mathematicians, and it is published by the American Mathematical Society. AMS Bookstore is where you can get it, and also on Amazon.
What?
And I also want to remind everyone of Shelley's book. Women. I'm actually being serious because I think it's so much a part of like what inspires me is that, like, you know, it's by demand that things change. And so I think, you know, finding books like the one that Shelley's written, finding books like by our local New Havener, Abdul Razak Zakaria, The Night Is Yours, a local author, and just wrote his first book, is a beautiful story. Just like really seeking out, there are so many wonderful people who provide reviews of books, especially for children, but not only. I think of Debbie Reese at the American Indian Children in Children's Literature Initiative, and just to really be conscious of about the things we put in front of children, and to do the work to make sure that those are uplifting voices that have been marginalized for all the reasons we know historically have created the patterns that we see.
And we have to say thank you to Harry.
Thank you,
the
thanks,
greatest
Harry.
Producer
and Tom.
In the history of the New Haven Independent. I mean, the man rocks and makes it work all the time.
Can I shout out somebody?
Okay.
I want to shout out somebody because she really gave me the idea for this book, but also because I want Lauren to hear her name. Her name is Sarah McSorley, and she wrote two books called Super Cool Scientists, and they're all women scientists.
Yes.
So I just wanted to shout her out. Hi, Sarah.
All right. Thank you, New Haven. It was a pleasure and an honor to be here with you.
As I got another rhyme, another rhythm for y'all to listen. I'm never quitting on my mission. I'ma roll with what I'm giving. Got some ambition, this new addition, filling positions. Looking at the void in myself and feeling what's missing. Better watch the way you're going, better go in the right direction. In the moment you stressing, but you gon' be counting blessings. And I know that for certain. Keep on working, open curtains, haters swerving, cause they ain't ready for your final version. Whoa. I'm never gon' give up, fall down, I just gotta get up, hey. Cause this is my road. Lights, camera, action, I'm ready to go. I'm never gonna give up, fall down, I just gotta get up, hey. Yeah, this is my road. Lights, camera, action, I'm ready to go. Way too long, we faced them storms. Now you gon' face the dawn you waited for. I said from night to dawn, I write my wrongs alone. In competition with warnings, ice galore. Now I'm running toward it, my lights are finished being a quitter. But little, little by little, they joking, telling some riddles. Now I'm in my section, ain't willing to give up. Know you getting knocked down, but you gotta get up. I'm never gon' give up, fall down, I just gotta get up, hey. Cause this is my road. Lights, camera, action, I'm ready to go. I'm never gonna give up, fall down, I just gotta get up, hey. Yeah, this is my road. Lights, camera, action.